from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In spite of testing negative for celiac disease, 3.1 million Americans still avoid gluten-containing products like bread and pasta. For some, it's a fad or a way to lose weight. For others, it's because they suffer from intestinal problems from gluten. But new research finds that following a gluten-free diet can have unintended consequences, like exposure to higher levels of arsenic or mercury. We'll hear about a new study on the risks of gluten-free diets, and we'll find out what that means for those with celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. It's all coming up next on Forum after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Gluten-free labels are increasingly common in grocery stores, but a new study published in the medical journal Epidemiology found higher concentrations of arsenic and mercury in people eating gluten-free diets. And a separate study from the Mayo Clinic found that while the number of people with celiac disease was stable from 2009 to 2014, the number of people who followed a gluten-free diet increased significantly in that same time frame. We're going to discuss the latest research on celiac disease and the potential benefits and risks of going gluten-free in this hour. We're joined for the hour by Dr. Joseph Murray, a gastroenterologist at the Mayo Clinic. Welcome, Dr. Murray. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, Michael.
And we're also going to hear from a clinical dietitian later in the hour. But first, I want to introduce Maria Argos, who is Assistant Professor of Epidemiology, University of Illinois, Chicago Public School of Health. Chicago School of Public Health. And she's also co-author of a new study, The Unintended Consequences of a Gluten-Free Diet. Welcome to the program, Maria Argos.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you on. And let's go into the study. First of all, believe it or not, there are people out there who may not know that gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, rye, and barley. It's a variety of grains and their flours. But we're talking about a study of rice, which is usually a substitute in gluten-free diets, and rice which shows emerging concerns and evidence of toxics. We're talking about mercury and arsenic. How dangerous are these levels?
So the levels that we observed in our study were still considered to be relatively low, but what was striking was that the levels were nearly twofold or double the levels observed in individuals reporting not consuming gluten-free diets. And so potentially because arsenic and mercury are unregulated sources of metals in our food supply, individuals who rely on an heavily rice-based diet may be potentially at risk of elevated exposure to these metals.
And this is a self-reporting study, really, of those people who are on a gluten-free diet, right?
Yes, that's right. So the other thing to note is that these are individuals that reported consumption of a gluten-free diet, although we did not have a measure of to what extent they were adherent to this diet and to what extent they relied on rice as a substitute grain in their diet. So again, those are important considerations when we think of the potential for exposure to metals.
So we need more studies, but when you mention things like mercury and arsenic, people immediately feel higher risk of cancer and other chronic diseases.
That's right. So the literature up to this point has really focused on exposure to arsenic in particular through drinking water sources. And so we know that arsenic at moderate to high levels has been very well established in relation to its cancer risk, cardiovascular disease risk, respiratory risk, and risk of other chronic diseases. Arsenic in food has not been very well characterized, as well as the health effects at lower levels of exposure. So that's really an area where there's a significant gap in the literature.
Again, we're talking with Maria Argos, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology. She's with us from Chicago and University of Illinois, Chicago School of Public Health, co-author of a new study, The Unintended Consequences of a Gluten-Free Diet. Actually, when we go back and look at celiac disease, I mean, there was a time when It was not even known to be an autoimmune disease. It was thought to be an allergy for quite a while. So are we still finding a lot of information out about not only celiac disease, but gluten that we need to find out? I was looking back at the history, for example, and there were people speculating that gluten was responsible for schizophrenia or for autism, all kinds of things.
So I think the literature in this area is still evolving. The majority of work that I do hasn't really been related to the clinical impacts of gluten, so others may be able to speak to this topic better than I can. Although we do know that even individuals who do not have clinical indications for gluten-free diets do find benefit from eating gluten-free. So there may be things like systemic inflammation that gluten is contributing to, and just in general, people may find that avoiding it in their diet may have personal beneficial effects, irrespective of clinical indication for it.
Yeah, well, we're going to go to Dr. Murray on these points. And Maria Argus, I thank you. Is the study available online?
Yes. So it's now available online in the Journal of Epidemiology, and so it should be publicly available to individuals.
Okay. And again, I thank you so much for joining us. Maria Argus, again, is Assistant Professor of Epidemiology, University of Illinois, Chicago School of Public Health. The new study is called The Unintended Consequences of a Gluten-Free Diet. Let's go to Joseph Murray, who's with us from Rochester, Minnesota, gastroenterologist of the Mayo Clinic, author of the Mayo Clinic's Going Gluten-Free, Essential Guide to Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. And we go back to the question I posed to Maria Argus. It's more in your bailiwick, Joseph Murray. That is, this for a long time, this was thought to be not an autoimmune disease.
Yeah, for a long time, it was regarded as a kind of a food intolerance. And celiac disease itself fits in somewhere between an allergy and a chronic inflammatory autoimmune condition. It is triggered by gluten. As you said, that's the protein in wheat, barley, and rye, which causes a more slow reaction within the intestine that can take weeks, months, or even years to come to fruition as a fully evolved disease. And we think people have this probably for many years before they get diagnosed. In fact, many don't ever get diagnosed. They can suffer in silence or maybe even not have any symptoms from this condition. I think you made the point that, this is an evolving area of research. If you go back even 10 years, I think most people in the general population hadn't even thought about gluten. Nowadays, we think of gluten as the new evil, almost, where it's been popularized in media and popular press as a potential health issue. And I think our studies and others have shown that lots of people have jumped on the gluten-free bandwagon, and there's lots of a profusion of gluten-free foods. And I think, as Dr. Argus and our studies have shown, it's not always good to avoid gluten, at least not for everyone.
Well, people are avoiding it for weight loss. They're avoiding it for athletic performance, for all kinds of health benefits, and some of it's fashionable. But there's this whole, I'm going to use a little medical jargon here, PWAGs. There's this whole area of people without celiac disease who are avoiding gluten. Over half of the 3.5 million people, actually, who have gluten-free diets. What about those people? What do we learn in terms of the symptoms and the relationship to gluten?
I think that what we've learned so far is that, as you said, many people are avoiding gluten. Some are doing it because they've heard gluten might be bad for them. Others are trying to help with some symptoms. Maybe they're digestive symptoms. Maybe they're not. Things like headache and fatigue are often things people will try a gluten-free diet, see if they get better. When somebody goes gluten-free, though, it's not simply avoiding gluten. They're often avoiding fast food, junk food, and certainly, when we would reduce our intake of fast food or junk food, we are probably going to feel better. At least some people will feel better anyway. And there may be some weight loss, at least initially, because we're restricting our intake. But, we are a very adaptable being. Humans are a very adaptable species. We will reset and start eating more again. And I think sometimes I often see patients who've avoided gluten for a few weeks. They feel better temporarily, but then they find their symptoms come back. But somehow or other, they become convinced that gluten was a problem, even though their symptoms are all back, despite them being gluten-free. And then they go and search for some other foods to avoid. And that's often a process that will lead to excessive food restriction and avoidance. And sometimes that can even become almost an eating disorder. So I am concerned about too much avoidance. I think also we need to be logical. And I often meet patients who have temporarily felt better avoiding gluten, and I'll say to them, well, do you still feel better? And they say, no, it didn't last that long. Well, then that's not success. So I've learned never as a doctor, don't disagree with success. But on the other hand, I think when there's been failure of a treatment, I think we have to rethink our thoughts about that. So yes, there are people who feel better on a gluten-free diet, but it's not always because of avoiding gluten.
But there's only 1% of the population that suffers from celiac disease, and you've got these numbers continuing to escalate about people who are going on gluten-free diets. The numbers, celiac, I believe, has leveled, has it not, Dr. Murray, off in numbers?
Yes. Yeah, so the numbers that we know of for celiac disease have stayed stable now for the last probably 6 or 8 years. We know this before this, there was, over the decades, there was a dramatic lead up from celiac disease being an exceptionally rare disease in the 50s and 60s and 70s to something that is now about 1 in 100 people. But that has stabilized. But as you said, the behavior of avoiding gluten has dramatically increased. And some of that is driven by probably people trying to find health benefits from altering their diet. I think as humans, we've always tried to alter our diet in the hopes that we can improve our health. But it's also been driven by industrial factors. We've got, you know, the gluten-free industry with advertising and marketing. There are books that have been written for popular press.
Dr. Murray, I'd like to give some figures for our listeners here, because by 2013, gluten-free food in the beverage industry grew to $10.5 billion. That's according to a market research company. And the FDA has noted on labeling that, you have to be essentially, in some cases, concerned about the detectability of gluten.
And that's absolutely true. I mean, if you're going to call something or label something gluten-free, we have to be able to verify that. And there still is debate about how we can best do that. I think it's important to point out that there's nothing intrinsically healthier about a gluten-free food product than one that contains gluten. In fact, many of the gluten-free foods are higher in fat, sugar, and salt, the magic three ingredients of the food industry to enhance taste. And the problem with that is if we switch to eating some of these higher calorie dense foods, more processed foods that happen to be gluten-free, that's not going to result in better health for people who do that.
Could some of the people who are being gluten-free and on gluten-free diets maybe experiencing a placebo effect?
Yes, indeed there is. And there's a term called the nocebo effect, which is the opposite, that is, where you expect to have harm or have symptoms when you're exposed to something that you think might be hurtful to you. And so we certainly think there may be a nocebo effect that people experience when they, say, go back to eating gluten after they've been gluten-free for a while.
Part of what prompts me to ask you that is there are some health professionals who claim that other than celiac disease, which, you know, it's like insulin for diabetes, avoiding gluten, there's no evidence that it can actually help health problems. How would you weigh in on that?
I'd weigh on that there are probably some individuals who have a form of, say, wheat sensitivity that could result in digestive symptoms, for example. There are also individuals who have perhaps symptoms away from maybe inflammatory symptoms in their body, and occasionally some of those patients will respond to gluten avoidance. However, the great majority of people don't have a biological problem with wheat or its components.
We're talking with Joseph Murray, MD, gastroenterologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and author of Mayo Clinic's Going Gluten-Free, Essential Guide to Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. And there's a name that always keeps coming up when you read about gluten and the science of gluten and so forth, and that is Alessio Fasano, who did a number of studies here in the United States, in fact, on gluten. And he came to the conclusion that, he said we should go back to gluten as a single protein. Can have, some healthy effects on some, others on not healthy effects, but it shouldn't be a fashionable diet like maybe some have associated with Miley Cyrus and at all. Pretty much agree with that, Dr. Murray?
Well, I think so. I think that certainly as a scientist, I think we need to address what is it about gluten or what is it about wheat that could produce symptoms in some and perhaps benefits in the other. And I think you've already mentioned, Michael, about in the discussion with Dr. Argos about what are the bad things that we might acquire when we go gluten-free, but what are the good things we miss when we go gluten-free? We're reducing the amount of fiber. Wheat is a major source of fiber in our diet. There are also B vitamins that many of the gluten-containing cereals are fortified with, and we don't get those. And there may also be the benefits of whole grain that are at least thought to reduce the risk of heart disease and perhaps for digestive health to have those whole grains. And largely when you go gluten-free, you lose those.
Your book is titled Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. What are the related conditions?
So the related conditions there include things like wheat allergy, probably wheat sensitivity, where people get digestive complaints from wheat, because there are other things in wheat that are immunologically active. That means they can stimulate our immune system beyond just the gluten for the patients with celiac disease. And some patients do experience those symptoms. Also within wheat, there are fructans, and fructans are part of the starch component of wheat. And that can induce gaseousness and bloating and distress in people who have a condition called irritable bowel syndrome. And some patients can benefit by limiting their intake of wheat and therefore reduce the intake of fructans and reduce some of those symptoms. And that may be a reasonable strategy certainly for some patients. So there is a spectrum of reactions. There's also a very rare but serious condition called wheat-dependent exercise-induced anaphylaxis. And basically, think of the scenario of somebody carb loads with wheat, they go and participate in a marathon or a long-distance run, and then they get anaphylaxis, a very severe life-threatening allergic reaction. And you have to have both of those. It's a very rare condition, but I have seen that condition in people who had another reaction to it.
Gee, and here I always thought it was just bee stings that lead to anaphylactic shock. You're opening my eyes to things here. And let me also invite our listeners to join this conversation. We're talking to Dr. Joseph Murray. We're going to talk with Leo Grappo, also a clinical dietitian at Stanford Healthcare, about this whole question of gluten in the diet. But we do want to hear from you, your experiences, your thoughts, your questions and concerns. I keep thinking about this book by Mary Jo Eustace that came across my desk called Scared Wheatless. Kind of said, I love the title. Feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, and we invite you to call us now. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website and post questions or comments there. That's kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. Or you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. A number of ways, obviously, to communicate with us. Let me read a comment that's come in from a listener named Joanne and get your response, Dr. Murray. She writes, as someone who has celiac disease, I am so sick of the gluten-free diet bashing. I have a choice, gluten-free or die. This is not an exaggeration. Rice contains arsenic, and most substitutes for bread and pasta use rice flour. No one who doesn't need a gluten-free diet will stick with it for long. It's expensive, it's limiting, and oftentimes the substitutes aren't up to snuff. Stop pretending it's a fun thing to do. Dr. Murray.
Oh, I have to say that, you know, I do agree with Joanne. Having dealt with thousands of patients with celiac disease, the gluten-free diet is not a choice. It is not a fad or a fashion. And I can certainly understand their frustration when they go to a restaurant, for example, and they say, I have to be gluten-free. And the person says, well, do you really need it? Or are you just, are you following the fashion or the fad? And that's very frustrating for someone who has a life-threatening and life-altering condition like celiac disease, where you have to totally avoid gluten for the rest of your life. So it's not a choice. And I certainly can understand the emotional impact that has. On the other side, the flip side is the wide availability of gluten-free options, the greater awareness of gluten as a health issue, may make it a little bit easier for patients with celiac disease to access gluten-free alternatives.
But you said earlier, and I want to just codify this a bit, you're at risk for other, nutritionist deficiencies, B12, zinc, those kinds of things. And it's also, as somebody pointed out, more expensive to go on a gluten-free diet.
Well, that is true. It is. There are downsides to the diet. So my bottom line is, if somebody does not need to be on this diet, they should not go on the diet. If someone has tried it and they felt benefit, they need to be tested for celiac disease, because that could be a genuine, well-validated medical condition that needs to be identified. But if they don't have celiac disease and they feel substantial benefit from being gluten-free, I don't really object to it. I do want to make sure that they are following a nutritionally complete diet without gluten.
And here's Laura, who writes, if you skip the gluten-free versions of breads and other baked goods, are there any adverse effects to living a gluten-free diet? While I do not have celiac, I have found that I feel more energetic and healthier without a lot of wheat in my diet. People act like I'm somehow denying myself some essential nutrients.
I don't think that there's a major problem. I mean, at least she's avoiding some of those unhealthy ingredients that are common in some of those gluten-free substitutes. And if she's following a diet that's got broad, you know, plant-based, fruit-based diet with modest or moderate amounts of other foods, I think that there's nothing wrong with that diet. In fact, there's a significant portion of the world's population who live quite well without ever seeing wheat. I would say, though, there is the expense issue. It's not only awkward or restrictive for the patient, but also for their families if somebody is having to adhere to a gluten-free diet. So there is a burden to that in more than just the individual.
Well, we're going to hear from some listeners. Let me go to a caller. Max is joining us. Max, you're on.
Yeah. Okay. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. three years ago, I changed my lifestyle.
I think he dropped that. Oh, go ahead. We lost you there for a second, but I think you're back. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Hi. So 3 years ago, I changed my diet and my lifestyle to avoid carbohydrates, specifically refined carbohydrates. So I'm on a very low carbohydrate diet, and I avoid gluten by proxy, and I feel incredible. My weight is stable. I have a physician. I monitor my blood, and my health, and I mean, really across the board, I've seen improvement. But by proxy, I avoid gluten.
Well, you do hear that kind of testimony, Dr. Murray, don't you?
Oh, I do indeed. And there's certainly many of the popular diets often are low in gluten. For example, another would be Atkins diet, often starts out quite low in gluten. And sometimes I'm trying to puzzle out, well, was the improvement in symptoms that occurred because of avoiding gluten or because of the generally healthy approach of avoiding refined carbohydrates, for example, as the caller, as Max has pointed out, can make most of us probably get exposed to too much refined carbohydrates like sugar or fructose, high fructose corn sweeteners, etc. We're probably getting too much of that in our diet anyway. But certainly we can be faced with trying to then go back and decide, is that improvement because of avoiding gluten? Does the patient have celiac disease? And that's a really very difficult thing to do once somebody's gone gluten-free. And I'd make the point that it's important if somebody has health problems and celiac disease is a possibility, they should be tested by the blood test before they go gluten-free, because the blood test is not so accurate anymore once they've been gluten-free for several weeks.
And we are going to continue this discussion. Again, we invite you to join us online, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum, or call us at 866-733-6786. Joseph Murray with us, MD from the Mayo Clinic. He's with us from Rochester, Minnesota. And we will indeed go to more of your calls and emails when we return. Just a comment from Elizabeth, who writes, this is not a gluten-free problem. It is a rice problem. And there are a lot of gluten-free grains besides rice to make flour with. Rice just happens to be one of the cheapest with a neutral flavor, but it is fairly empty nutrition-wise. We'll hear from more of you when we return. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We began this hour talking about a study that finds higher arsenic and mercury exposure in those who follow a gluten-free diet. We've been talking about gluten generally and celiac disease and diet and much more. Maria Argos joined us initially to talk about that study, which is called The Unintended Consequences of a Gluten-Free Diet. And we have Joseph Murray with us, who's a gastroenterologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and author of the Mayo Clinic's Going Gluten-Free, Essential Guide to Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. We do invite your participation in the program. You can call us 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQED Forum. We're going to go more of your calls, and we go to Sebastopol and welcome Diane. You're on the air.
Hi. Years ago, when the gluten-free diet craze was sweeping West Sonoma County, I read something, and I'm sorry I can't quote the source, that said that in the 70s, through selective breeding, wheat was bred for uniform height for ease in harvesting, and that this fundamentally affected the nature of the wheat proteins, and that that is this altered wheat protein from the 70s is the source of the gastrointestinal problems that people have with wheat. Does your expert know anything about that?
Joseph Murray.
Well, certainly, Diane, there's been a lot of interest in whether wheat genetics have changed to the point that it's changed how wheat interacts with our immune system. It looks like that even though the genetic hybridization that you talk about, which has really maximized the yield of wheat by instead of the wheat growing to a significant height, it dwarf wheat has become the dominant wheat, and they put all its energy into generating seeds. But the research that's been done looking at that question does not find any significant change in the seeds themselves, that the wheat proteins, the main gluten proteins, have not actually changed. They're just bigger. There are more seeds produced per plant and per acre. The yield is greater. Where there may be differences is how we use wheat in our foodstuffs. For example, now bread often includes purified gluten or what's called vital gluten as an added ingredient to help with industrial bread making. That is a new process. That did change in the 60s and 70s. So that is a change. There is not really genetically modified wheat in the context of GMOs, for example. That's never been successful commercially. So it's not like corn or soybeans or the other common commercial grains that have been genetically modified. So the hybridization that's occurred has really maximized yield, maximized the ability to harvest efficiently, but it hasn't really changed the proteins themselves.
As long as we're on wheat, just for a moment, if we could, Dr. Murray, Sid writes that his son has a severe allergy to wheat, so he has no choice but to eat a gluten-free diet. He wants to know, how worried should we be? Should we have him tested for arsenic and mercury levels, and what are our alternatives?
Okay, so I think that when we put in context the heavy metal issues, so the arsenic, lead, cadmium, et cetera, the levels that are seen in these subjects who are avoiding gluten are not toxic. They don't even get close to the toxic levels. Now, we don't know how long people had been on a gluten-free diet, so we don't know if that accumulation will continue over time. And I think there is a need to follow people to find out if people on a gluten-free diet over years are going to continue to accumulate. I think your other caller had mentioned that this is a rice problem. You know, different rice production has different arsenic levels. It's very much dependent on what the water that's used. Rice is a very water-intense crop. Where does the water come from? Is it a high arsenic background level? Because it may accumulate within the grain.
What about the differences between white rice and brown rice here? Do we know?
Well, brown rice includes the covering, and
yeah,
the covering may actually contain more of that. Though
really?
Probably the goodness of rice is more in the brown, where you can get the fiber, et cetera, than in the white, which is essentially not much more than starch.
It's like eating sugar, the white rice, I mean, you know.
To some degree.
To some degree, right. Dr. Oz said it's like eating broken glass. I think he was going a little hyperbolic on us there. But
maybe.
A couple good questions. Paul wants to know, what is the diagnostic process for celiac disease? I have members of my extended family that avoid gluten for various reasons, but none that have sought verification of the disease.
Excellent point. So for Paul, if Paul is on a gluten-containing diet, basically on a normal diet, then there are some blood tests. We call them the tissue transglutaminase, or TTG antibody for short. Commonly performed test. Virtually every doctor now is aware of these tests, and so long as the patient's on a gluten-containing diet, those tests are very sensitive for finding celiac disease. For the individuals who've been on a gluten-free diet for months or years, those tests are less accurate. There is a genetic test that can predict if someone belongs to the third, and it's fully one-third of the population who are genetically able to get celiac disease. Two-thirds cannot. So if you belong to those two-thirds, you're free and clear. You cannot have celiac disease. And the good thing about the genetic test is you don't need to go back on a gluten challenge. Whereas other individuals who've been on a gluten-free diet for months, if they have the genetic type, then unfortunately we're faced with putting them back on gluten. And for patients with real celiac disease, that can be very uncomfortable.
I just want to give some numbers here. Millions of people all over the world actually have eliminated gluten from their diets, and 25% of Americans have reported consuming gluten-free food. That was in 2015. A quick question, Dr. Murray, from Christopher. It says, my wife is 13 weeks pregnant and has been gluten intolerant for the past 5 years. How might a gluten-free diet affect the fetus?
Probably not at all. I do think that I might be, based on the data that we've heard, I don't think I'd be using an awful lot of rice. As another caller pointed out, there are lots of other grains that perhaps have more intrinsic benefit, everything from quinoa to teff to amaranth. I mean, these are not so common grains, but they're available in many of the health food stores, and even now some mainline food stores will contain foods made from this. But a general healthy diet that includes fruits, vegetables, meats in reasonable quantities, things like this, are perfectly healthy for a mother.
I want to read a tweet from a listener. It says, eating gluten-free doesn't cost more money. It doesn't cost more to purchase whole foods that are already gluten-free. It costs more when you buy into the hype. I want to go to Leah Gropo, who's a clinical dietitian at Stanford Healthcare, joining us by phone from the Stanford campus. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is just talking about, from your perspective as a nutritionist and a clinical dietitian, well, what about the health overall of gluten-free diets? Let's put aside the recent study about mercury and the likelihood of arsenic. I mean, there's a lot of junk food that's called gluten-free, isn't there?
Yeah, so I think when we look at gluten-free diets, we need to make a differentiation between gluten-free processed foods and processed foods in general. So I do know a lot of the people that I see come in and decide to go on a gluten-free diet, and nothing changes. They're trying to lose weight, or maybe they're trying to manage their blood sugars, something along those lines. But they've done it by going to, if they used to have a cookie that had gluten in it, so flour products, wheat products, now they go to a cookie that says it's gluten-free, assuming that by being gluten-free, it's inherently healthier, less calories, less carbohydrates, which is not the case typically. So I think if you're thinking about doing a gluten-free diet, it's not really indicated if you do not have a diagnosis of celiac disease, but I do really respect that nutrition and food choices are really an individual choice. And so if you want to go to a gluten-free diet, really the healthy way would be to think about where you can get carbohydrate sources from unprocessed foods, like legumes, different types of beans, quinoa, things like that, things you would prepare at home instead of things that you buy prepackaged.
So when people are removing gluten, a lot of people are removing gluten from a lot of foods just to taste better. They should maybe add calories, add carbs, those kinds of things?
So more of a replacement. So if before you used to do pasta, you can try something like maybe an edamame pasta or a black bean pasta. Some of my patients I work with really find those to be appealing to them. So I think that in the end, it's a choice. But just going gluten-free does not give you a free hall pass to saying that now all of your foods are healthy just because it says it's gluten-free. You still need to be a really savvy consumer and try to have foods that are not processed, so whole foods. I always try to tell people, think about how Mother Nature made the food and try to eat it as close to that as possible. So getting a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables in your diet and looking at them and being able to see that it's still very similar to how Mother Nature made it.
Well, Leah Gropo, we're getting a lot of questions about food processing. For example, Greg wants to know, has the modern process of converting wheat to flour exacerbated the problem?
So when we're looking at things about glucose, blood sugar rise, and how we process foods, the more processed, so the more pulverized the grains are, the more it's going to digest rapidly. So taking a step back, it is a healthier choice to eat a food that is less processed. So steel-cut oats versus refined or quick-cooking oats.
So what do you recommend? I had mentioned earlier a book called Scared Wheatless, a lot of recipes in there in terms of avoiding gluten and the like. What do you recommend generally as far as eating a balanced diet vis-a-vis gluten?
Yeah, so I would say that a lot of people put a lot of energy into the food choices that they're going to eat, and focusing just going on gluten-free, that's, I wouldn't want to say it's wasted energy if you don't have celiac disease, but that's a lot of extra thought process you have to go to, versus if you're looking at just a healthy diet for the general population, thinking about having half your plate non-starchy vegetables, getting in a lot of color, thinking about lean proteins, a quarter of your plate, and then your carbohydrate sources, a quarter of your plate. So trying to go back to that would be a better use of your brain time than thinking about always choosing the gluten-free product.
So you do not recommend going on a gluten-free diet to lose weight? Or
typically not. However, some people come in and tell me, I've lost a lot of weight on this gluten-free diet. But when we go back and we look at what changes happened, they're more aware of the foods they're eating. They're eating more salads, more lean proteins, less processed foods. So by going to a gluten-free diet, they actually really reinvented the foods that they're eating instead of just did a one-for-one. So if at 3 p.m. they had a chocolate chip cookie, now at 3 p.m. they have a gluten-free chocolate chip cookie, because that would not result in weight loss.
Leah Gropo, again, is clinical dietitian at Stafford Healthcare. And thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And we're going to have some more of our calls. Dr. Murray is still with us. Joseph Murray, gastroenterologist at the Mayo Clinic. Let me go to more of your phone calls. I'm going to go to Oklahoma. Shane, you're on the air. Morning.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. A question for Dr. Murray. I'm just concerned we're not addressing the fact that a vast majority of our wheat crops and the real majority of our corn and soy is sprayed with Roundup. Most of the corn and soy crops are Roundup ready these days, genetically modified, and a lot of the wheat is too. Just wondered if some of these issues could be a result of the toxic chemicals we're putting on our food every day in mass production, because my wife and I make homemade pizza dough and homemade bread, and we certainly feel the difference when we use organic flour versus conventional.
So what about Roundup, Dr. Murray? Can you shed light?
Well, I have to confess, Shane, I don't have an answer for him. I certainly am, as a consumer myself, I'm concerned about whether any of these chemicals that are used to enhance the yield, for example, of our industrial food crops, do they have an end effect biologically? There's very little actual evidence that's been done to show that. But I certainly share Shane's concerns in general. And also, I think what we've already heard from the dietitian is less processed is good. You know, get back to, I won't say more solid food, but back to the original food. Another example is juice, for example. Juice is not as healthy for you as the original, eating the actual solid fruit it came from. So less processing before we actually eat the food is good. But whether we can blame Roundup as a cause, I don't think there's any data that actually shows us that Roundup could drive the immune problem that is celiac disease.
But I think we do know that organic rice is no safer, for example, than other rice with regard to arsenic and mercury, those kinds of things.
I'm afraid that the source is from the groundwater that's used.
Yeah. Let me thank the caller and go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Jeanette. Jeanette, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi, I have a friend who does gluten-free for herself and her children, and she thinks that if they get gluten, within about 6 hours, 3 hours, she notices something that she considers symptoms, like dark circles or behavior changes or something like that. Can a reaction to gluten or that produce an effect so quickly?
Well, first on the quick response, say celiac disease, patients who have celiac disease who get exposed to gluten can get symptoms within 30 minutes, even an hour, something we didn't think previously possible, but it's commonly reported. Patients with allergies can respond within minutes. Now, the type of symptoms that your friend reports in her children, that's a little bit harder to make a true biological connection. You wonder about whether, you know, are they also doing other things that go with it? For example, are they eating a very large meal that contains lots of sugars or lots of fat? Are they also partaking in video games or something else that might give them dark circles under their eyes? I think we have to be very careful about taking anecdote and then translating that into understanding. And so I like to use the phrase that no matter how high you pile anecdotal stories, it does not science make. So I think we have to be careful about drawing conclusions. The other is, for a child being gluten-free in our current world, that's pretty restrictive. especially when it comes to going to school, eating out, social occasions. They can feel quite restrictive, and that does have a burden on the child, and of course a burden on the family that might not always be justified.
And let me thank the caller. A listener tweets, is there such thing as gluten sensitivity? Kind of in new territory there in many ways as far as or the early science of being able to answer that question, aren't we, Dr. Murray?
Yes, I think so. And I think the caller said it may not even be gluten sensitivity outside of celiac disease. It may be wheat sensitivity because we know that within wheat there are other molecules that can excite an immune response. That doesn't mean it's good or bad. But in some people, it might excite some symptoms that could make them distressed.
And Emma wants to know, is it possible, this may again be out of your realm, Dr. Murray, but is it possible the use of antibiotics have modified our intestinal flora, fauna, and that contributes to intestinal problems?
Well, that's a very interesting question because we are starting to know that the microbiota, those are our own resident bugs, are very important in either taming or adapting our immune system. And in celiac disease, there are differences in our bugs at the time of diagnosis and even follow-up. We also know that when someone goes on a gluten-free diet for any reason, it changes your resident microbiota and maybe not for the better. So we do think that our bugs, now of course, taking an antibiotic is like declaring nuclear war on your own bacteria. Now, we are pretty resilient, both ourselves as human host, but also our bacteria. Pretty resilient, they'll return. But it's not without possibly some consequence. So I wouldn't put it, even though right now it's in the realm of speculation, I think there may be some rationale why there might be a role for altering our bugs in good or bad ways that might impact the likelihood of diseases like celiac disease.
And again, Dr. Joseph Murray with us from the Mayo Clinic is author of the Mayo Clinic's Going Gluten-Free, Essential Guide to Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. And here's Katie. Katie, you're on. Welcome.
Yes. Hi, thank you for taking my call. With my first pregnancy, I became wheat intolerant. And with my second pregnancy, I became gluten sensitive. And I've since cut them out of my diet, and I'm curious. I know there was another caller speaking about this in regards to pregnancy, but is there any substantiated research regarding biological changes and in relation to allergies due to pregnancy? Or can the doctor speak a little bit about what I may or may not be experiencing?
So, Katie, a very interesting story. We know that during pregnancy, that the mother's body has to adapt to the foreign body, that is the fetus. And so parts of the immune system are suppressed to accommodate that foreign body. That also changes somebody's immune system. And then right after childbirth, that completely reverses. And there can even be some overshoot in that reversal. And I'll often see patients with celiac disease who present with symptoms first in the days or weeks after delivery of a child. There are other things, we know there are some other diseases that are also suppressed during pregnancy because the hormones of pregnancy suppress the immune system to some degree. But on the other side, there are some other diseases or other immune diseases that get worse during pregnancy, again, because of the dramatic shifts of the immune system that occur in a mother's body in order to accommodate that foreign body, which is the child. But I wouldn't discount the possibility that certainly somebody could develop a reaction after the pregnancy. Similarly, I often see patients' symptoms are suppressed during pregnancy. And they look back and say, I was healthiest during certain periods of pregnancy, and then I got really sick after delivery.
And Katie, we thank you for the call. I want to go right to another caller. Sarah, thanks for waiting. You're on. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm celiac and have been diagnosed for about 5 years. I maintain a gluten-free diet. And every once in a while, get the blood test done that the doctor was recommending earlier just to see where my levels are at. And I'm curious, if one of the blood tests that is done when tested for celiac disease still comes back as positive, yet I'm maintaining a gluten-free diet, what could that refer to?
Okay, so Sarah, it could well be that for example, that sometimes the body's immune system or immune memory takes an awfully long time to forget its reaction to gluten. So sometimes it's just because it can take years for an adult especially to lose that reaction that's measurable in the blood. It also can be low-level contamination. And so I often am looking, is there any kind of possibility that there is some low-level cross-contamination occurring? The biggest exposure for that is eating out, where people are dependent on others for preparing their food. So it depends. It also depends on which test, because there are several different tests. Some of them are more accurate than others. But I think we also have to remember that the tests were designed for detection. They weren't really designed for monitoring. And while we use those, they're really not good tests. We need much better tests to determine. And then sometimes I will subject people to a follow-up biopsy where we put a scope down, take some biopsies from their intestine, and make sure that the damage is healed. And if the damage is healed, then I have no concerns for that subject, for that person.
And let me thank Sarah for the call. You know, one kind of elephant in the room we haven't gotten to, Dr. Murray, is the fact that this is a white person's disease. I'm curious about that and what you have to say about it.
Yeah, so it is curious that this is Caucasian. It is people who originated from Europe primarily, but also North Africa and the Middle East. Some of the largest concentrations of celiac disease are North India, for example, but they are Caucasian. It may have slightly darker skin than people from Western Europe, but they also have celiac disease. But you go to sub-Saharan Africa or African Americans here in the U.S., very rare to find celiac disease. It's interesting in Mexico, for example, a colleague of mine did a study in Mexico City, found lots of hidden celiac disease. But when we look at Mexican Americans here in the U.S., not so much. So there are some very ethnic differences. That's due largely to genetics that the Europeans developed. And I have to think that there has got to be some benefit to having had those genetics and having eaten wheat, because Western civilization is based on wheat.
And more on wheat from Robin in Kensington. Welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. I really do appreciate this discussion. I have had in 2002, I had a series of bouts of systemic wide hives that became anaphylaxis before I was diagnosed by an allergist with a wheat allergy, and specifically a wheat allergy. So I'm wheat-free, but because of the prevalence of gluten-free products out there, I am, when I eat out, I am gluten-free, and when I eat home, I can bake and cook with other types of flours and starches. So I am very happy for the greater awareness and product labeling that is out there, because back in 2002, and especially living in the East Coast, it was very difficult to find food or people in the food industry who understood what a wheat allergy means. My take on this is a little bit different. I do understand people are out there looking for ways to be healthier, but I do think gluten-free or going gluten-free has become a fad for many people. As we've heard other callers and the experts say, it's not really necessary if there isn't a medical condition for this. But people do find that they feel better or believe they are less grumpy or what have you, not to diminish people that have those symptoms. But I do think there's kind of a false, or it's created a false awareness out there that I've encountered with my specific reaction to wheat. And that is, servers and others don't really always understand that people can die from a wheat allergy. And so a little bit of soy sauce, while it may not hurt people as significantly who have a sensitivity or think they may be sensitive, for me it can be a very serious situation, meaning I have to go to the hospital and I need, you know, to be treated immediately. And so I just raise that because I think out there there's been a little bit of overreaction, perhaps.
Well, Robin, I'm glad you raised it and certainly also brought attention to what may indeed be overreaction, and I thank you so much for that call. We'll go to some more callers in a moment, but Sharon asks, and let me go to you on this again, Dr. Murray, once you're diagnosed with celiac disease, does it ever go away?
That's an excellent point. It typically does not. Once you have developed celiac disease, your immune system has a memory for gluten. So even if you don't see gluten for 10 years after that, and then you get gluten, it will remember it. and will react. So we can heal people. So the intestine can heal in most, not everyone can heal, avoiding gluten, very strictly avoiding gluten. But if the, but that memory remains, if gluten gets back into the system, the body will react. It may not react straight away, but it will react over time.
Your intestines have the memory, as it were.
They have the memory.
Yeah. And here's Anne. Anne, join us. You're on. Hi.
Hi. I wonder whether there is a connection between diabetes and consumption of gluten. And I actually Googled this once and got a very strange answer. But basically, the answer was that gluten is the highest relationship between diabetes and any other thing that one might consume is gluten. Now, I know that gluten develops naturally when a baker is making bread and kneading the dough, and the gluten develops. And so my other question...
Well, Anne, let me just go to the first question about the connection between gluten and diabetes, because we are running short on time here. Dr. Murray?
So type 1 diabetes, that's early onset diabetes, children often, but also young adults go straight onto insulin. That's an autoimmune condition very closely related to celiac disease. About 5 or 6% of people with type 1 diabetes will get celiac disease or have celiac disease. Going the other direction, do we think gluten is causing the diabetes? The data on that is very weak indeed, and I wouldn't want to even speculate that there could be a causal effect. But you see it occurring in the same people, and you can see the two diseases occurring in the same families. The other type of diabetes, that's later onset diabetes, wheat is the major source of starch. And I think our dietitian already talked about the refined wheat flour is essentially almost like pure sugar. It's got a very high glycemic index.
I'm diabetic. I have to avoid it. the starches. And thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Murray. Appreciate the time you spent
with
us very
me.
Much. Joseph Murray, again, is gastroenterologist at the Mayo Clinic, author of Going Gluten-Free, Essential Guide to Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour repeated in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.